Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Dr. James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, who assesses the campaign in Michigan's Democratic primary that sent President Biden a message of strong opposition to his handling of Israel's slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza. Ofer Naiman, a Jewish Israeli anti-apartheid peace activist, who talks about the current political climate in Israel as he urges the world to hold Israeli institutions accountable for occupation, apartheid, and genocide. And Thomas McCosher, a former Connecticut complex litigation judge, who discusses his concern that the U.S. Supreme Court's delay in Trump's 2020 election obstruction trial could take America down the dark road to dictatorship. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
American natural gas suppliers are looking toward Mexico to build export terminals to ship liquefied natural gas from the west coast of Mexico to Asia, bypassing the recent Biden administration pause on issuing new permits for LNG terminals. This comes as the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission just approved the Saguaro Connector pipeline from the fracked gas fields in West Texas to planned export terminals on Mexico's Pacific coast. The goal is to cut shipping time and avoid the increasingly crowded Panama Canal. Scientists expect the shift to exports from Mexico will increase climate-damaging carbon and methane emissions and also damage the Gulf of California's environmentally sensitive ecosystem. Fossil fuel companies expect to benefit from weaker Mexican environmental standards. Recent studies have concluded that natural gas, long touted by the fossil fuel industry as cleaner to burn than oil or coal, is often as big a driver of climate change as coal, due to large methane leaks at drill sites. LNG shipped long distances around the world also consumes large amounts of energy, and the process of liquefying gas to make it suitable for transport is incredibly energy intensive. With a growing shortage of affordable housing, Washington State is looking to impose a new mansion tax on real estate sales over $3 million and reduce the tax rate on real estate transfers below $700,000. The goal is to create a reliable revenue stream for the state's housing trust fund. Mansion taxes are increasingly popular in progressive states and a growing number of cities, like Los Angeles, Chicago, and Santa Fe. But the Stateline News Service reports that the tax designed to generate funds for affordable housing and to combat homelessness faces strong opposition from the real estate industry, which is challenging the mansion tax in court. In mid-March, voters in Chicago will consider a proposal endorsed by Mayor Brandon Johnson to increase real estate taxes on expensive properties to fund homeless services, while the city's Building Owners and Managers Association claims it would further harm downtown commercial real estate, still reeling from the pandemic. Meanwhile, Massachusetts legislators are debating a bill that would allow cities to impose their own real estate transfer tax on the sale of homes sold for over $1 million. As the bloody siege of Gaza enters its fifth month, pro-Israel groups in the U.S. are increasing their attacks on progressives and defenders of Palestinian rights. But AIPAC, the leading pro-Israel lobby, may have another agenda to help Republicans win swing districts in this November's general election. California's 47th congressional district in Orange County had one of the closest House races in 2022. Candidates there are now competing in the Democratic primary to replace Representative Katie Porter, who is now running for U.S. Senate. State Senator David Minn, a former aide to Senator Chuck Schumer, is the front-runner in the primary and is seen as a mainstream Democrat who is pro-Israel. but AIPAC endorsed Democrat Joanna Weiss, who is also supported by a number of pro-Israel groups. AIPAC attacked Min over his arrest on drunk driving charges last May. Neither candidate has called for a ceasefire in Gaza. United Democracy Project, a pro-Israel PAC funded by many Republican donors, spent $600,000 on TV ads as well as a direct mail campaign targeting Min. Dan Driscoll, Min's campaign manager, told the American Prospect, "This is not about Israel policy. This is about a right-wing agenda and MAGA donors targeting the strongest Democrat in the race." Democrats had to deal with AIPAC's lavish funding of their primary candidates in the last midterm election in 2022, and many observers conclude that it succeeded in muting Democratic opposition to Israel's current devastating war in Gaza. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Following the latest massacre in Gaza, where more than 100 desperately hungry Palestinian civilians were killed, with some 750 others wounded, after Israeli troops opened fire on crowds waiting for food aid near Gaza City, President Biden ordered U.S. military cargo planes to airdrop 38,000 meals into Gaza. Humanitarian aid groups criticize Israel for blocking most aid trucks from entering Gaza by land, and said the U.S. airdrop was inefficient and little more than a public relations move. More than 30,500 Palestinians have now been killed in Gaza, with another 70,000 wounded, since the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages. Negotiations in Cairo trying to broker agreement on a proposed six-week ceasefire in Gaza appear to have stalled, just days before an unofficial deadline of March 10th, the start date of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has threatened to launch a military offensive against the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinians have sought refuge from the conflict, if Israeli hostages held by Hamas are not freed. Your reporter spoke with Dr. James Zogby, co-founder and president of the Arab American Institute, who talks about the campaign in Michigan's February 27th Democratic primary that urged voters to cast their ballots for uncommitted rather than Joe Biden. More than 100,000, or 13% of the ballots, were cast for uncommitted, sending the president a clear message of opposition to his handling of Israel's slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, the campaign was brilliantly organized, and it was a three-week campaign. They had phone banking set up where hundreds of people from lists where we sent out to people, and we said, you can join the phone banking. You know, you get numbers on your computer from a central source. You make the calls. You record the responses. They did it the way one would do a presidential campaign. It was a great job. They had the support of 30-plus elected officials initially. They got the support of former Congressman Andy Levin. Obviously, Rashida Tlaib was in the mix from the beginning. There were black elected officials, obviously Arab elected officials. It was a huge undertaking, and they did a brilliant job. And they made the point, because Michigan is critical. I mean, there's almost no way to come up with an electoral college map where Democrats win if you don't win Michigan. And 100,000 people voting uncommitted sends a message that the Biden campaign may be in trouble if they don't pay attention to what people want. Now, I've heard back from people saying, well, then you're just supporting Trump. And I say, no. And they say, well, then you should put aside your single issue and support Biden regardless of what he does on this. And I say, you wouldn't say that to any other community about their deeply felt concern. You would say to the candidate, pay attention to them. What if the tables were turned? And the Jewish community said, we're upset, and we're not voting for Joe Biden. We're going to send him a message that he better change. Would we be saying to them, "Oh, get over your single issue"? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't. We wouldn't say it to Black voters. We wouldn't say it to Latino voters. We wouldn't say it to women. We wouldn't say it to gays. Is it so easy to say to Arabs, get over the fact that 30,000 people are dead, 70,000 people wounded, Gaza destroyed, genocide unfolding, and you're upset that the president's not doing anything about it? Why should we be less in the eyes of the administration than any other community? And the answer is we're not. And so we're not voting against Joe Biden. We're sending him a message that you have to do something to earn our support. Just like any other community would say, you need to do something to earn our support. You need to do it for us, too. You want to win Michigan? You got to help us find the reason to encourage people to go for you. I worked hard in 2020. I worked for Bernie, and then I switched, you know, after he won the primary to get people to vote for him. I can't do that now because I know that my people are hurting and I'm hurting, and I need the president to show us more.
Well said, Dr. Zoghbi. We only have a minute or two left, and I wanted to ask you this. I hear the campaign to gather uncommitted votes to send Joe Biden a message about his policy in Gaza is moving to other states now on Super Tuesday, Colorado, Minnesota, North Carolina, among them. When those votes come in, what is it that Joe Biden can do right now to win these voters back in a critical election where very often we have presidential candidates competing against each other? And it's often a race, you know, of choosing the lesser evil. But mm-hmm. in this case, with Donald Trump, many people are of the view that democracy itself is at stake.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. It is. And I want to do everything I can to stop Donald Trump in his tracks. But Joe Biden's got to give us more, to give us the way to go out to people who are feeling this issue as deeply as they felt anything in their lives. And look, I just want to sort of not have expectations be too high about other states. I think that the sentiment from all the polling that I've done is clear nationwide. Arab Americans are not supporting Joe Biden the way they did in 2020. And neither are young voters. Neither are people of color. I mean, we're finding numbers dropping 10, 15, 20% from where they were in 2020. And it's a range of issues. But Gaza is important. Two-thirds of the constituencies I mentioned say that they're upset with Joe Biden's Gaza policy. So he has to recognize that. That it won't necessarily translate into North Carolina, Colorado, or state of Washington in the way it did in Michigan, because it wasn't just a spontaneous, we're upset. We had to work hard to turn people out to vote uncommitted. It's easy to get people to vote for Bernie. It's easy to get people to vote for Jesse. I worked on both of those campaigns. When they care about the person, when you're getting them to vote uncommitted, these are people who weren't going to vote at all. And so I'm not suggesting that the uncommitted vote goes to Trump. What I'm saying it more is that the uncommitted vote will stay home in November. They will not feel the incentive to vote. And I think that that will be the case in North Carolina, Colorado, and Washington, where because they don't have the same engine driving this that we did in Michigan, I think that the turnout won't be as great.
That was Dr. James Zoghbi, co-founder and president of the Arab American Institute. Find more analysis and commentary on Israel's catastrophic war in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The genocidal war in Gaza continues, with the documented deaths of more than 30,000 Palestinians, while an untold number of civilians lie buried in the rubble. As the war claims the lives of Israeli soldiers, and Israel's standing in the world has dramatically fallen, most Israelis, or at least most Jewish Israelis, continue to support the war. Underscoring the pro-war sentiment, a public opinion poll published by Israel's Channel 12 on January 31st found that 72% of Israeli voters agreed that all humanitarian aid to Gaza should be halted until the 134 Israeli hostages believed to be still held by Hamas are released. Ofer Naiman is a Jewish-Israeli anti-apartheid activist and member of Boycott From Within, a group of Israeli citizens who support the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, campaign. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Naiman about the current political climate in Israel and how the war is affecting both Israeli and Palestinian citizens and Palestinians living under occupation.
Overall, yes, Jewish-Israeli citizens are quite privileged here, and I can say that this is a genocide. I can post that on social media, and I'm not going to be arrested for doing so. There was more repression during the first weeks of the war and the genocide, but I think now we're pretty much back to normal levels of extensive freedom that we as Jewish-Israeli citizens have and we must use. So I can post stuff on social media, but of course, going to a demonstration may not be safe. We face police brutality and also some attacks by fascists. And of course, some people have problems in their workplace, maybe isolated from their friends and families. So for some people, it's very hard.
So you mentioned freedom of speech that Jewish Israelis have. What about Palestinian citizens of Israel?
No, Palestinian citizens of Israel, they have to be very careful or else they may be detained for organizing a demonstration, for posting something on Facebook. And of course, Palestinians living under occupation in the West Bank, even less so. They can easily be detained without trial for months for speaking out against occupation and apartheid and genocide.
I mean, things in the West Bank have gotten much worse, and things in Gaza, of course, are apocalyptic. You mentioned that demonstrations might not be safe. What do those look like? Are they very large? And does it have people from across the spectrum participating? In other words, both Jewish Israelis and Palestinian Israelis?
There was a fairly large demonstration yesterday in Tel Aviv, especially after the recent massacre in Gaza. Overall, these demonstrations, they're not large. Hundreds of people, perhaps, not mass demonstrations. There are somewhat close demonstrations by families of the captives currently held in Gaza for a ceasefire and an exchange deal. But when it comes to demonstrations that focus on the crimes being committed in our name in Gaza, these demonstrations are small. The demonstration I went to in Jerusalem today, around 100 people perhaps, and there was some police brutality. The police tore and snatched some signs, for example, calling this a massacre, calling it a genocide.
I know that the protests by the families of the hostages who remain in Gaza have been pretty big, and they want a ceasefire, and you all want a ceasefire, even though your politics are probably different. Is there any room for collaboration on that issue? Is there any chance of having, you know, a bigger demonstration with people who have different politics but both have the view of wanting a ceasefire?
Well, it's interesting because we were demonstrating today in central Jerusalem, and that was like 50 yards from the small encampment which the families of Israeli captives in Gaza have set up next to the prime minister's residence. But they were doing their own thing and we were doing our own thing. There is some overlap. For example, there is a group of mothers of soldiers currently serving in Gaza who are calling for a ceasefire and an exchange deal and for getting the soldiers out of Gaza. Overall, I can see why the families of the captives would stay away from a protest that focuses on the genocide and the massacre in Gaza. Their message is bring them home. And I sympathize with this message as long as it's clear that the only way to do so is by a ceasefire and an exchange deal rather than prolonging the war.
Is there anything else about what's going on in Israel right now that has changed because of the war?
I think that politically the future here belongs to the more liberal part of Israeli society. And it's going to be up to the world, especially to Americans, to hold these liberal Israelis accountable as well, because there is this tendency to regard only Netanyahu and the hardline settlers as the problem here in Israel. I think the problem is also the mainstream, but the mainstream is more malleable. So the question is, what's going to happen? I mean, if we see strong sanctions, international sanctions on Israel, I think it will signal to Israeli liberals that they must work harder to end the occupation, also in the West Bank, to remove the settlements. And it will also boost the general struggle to decolonize this place. Overall, my message would be the Israeli right wing, of course, is a brutal enemy of anyone who wants peace and human rights. But pay close attention to the Israeli mainstream and hold all Israeli institutions accountable for occupation, apartheid, and genocide.
That was Ofer Naiman, an anti-apartheid Israeli peace activist living in Jerusalem. Learn more about the Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 4th, the U.S. Supreme Court announced their unanimous rejection of Colorado's disqualification of former President Donald Trump on the state's primary ballot under Section 3 of the Constitution's 14th Amendment because he engaged in insurrection by trying to overturn the 2020 election. Four justices disagreed with the majority's ruling that Congress must first pass legislation to enforce disqualification of insurrectionist candidates. This widely expected ruling followed the High Court's February 28th announcement that it would hear Trump's claim that he's immune from prosecution for any crimes he committed while president, including the four felony charges related to his role in the multi-pronged effort in violent January 6 insurrection to overturn his election loss to Joe Biden. Because the nation's second highest court, the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, had already ruled against Trump's immunity claim, most observers predicted the Supreme Court would reject the appeal and allow Special Counsel Jack Smith's trial to proceed. But instead, the justices scheduled oral arguments on Trump's immunity claim for April 22nd and may not issue a ruling until the end of their term in June, making it unlikely that Trump's election conspiracy trial would go forward before the November election. Your reporter spoke with Thomas McCosher, a former Connecticut complex litigation judge, who discusses his concern that the Supreme Court's action, delaying Trump's election obstruction trial, could take America down the dark road to dictatorship.
Well, if they accept his argument, or even anything close to his argument, then they're setting up a situation in which the president only needs to hang on to one-third of the U.S. senators in an impeachment proceeding to do whatever he wants, including kill people, for instance, because his own lawyers said that the only remedy for a president of the United States who decided to send SEAL Team 6 to kill his political opponents, the only remedy would be to impeach and convict and then prosecute the president. So if a president held on to just one-third of the United States Senate, they can run around killing people, doing whatever they want, according to Trump's position. And I have to believe that a majority of the Supreme Court will utterly reject that. My fear is they won't all reject that. You know, perhaps Justice Thomas will go the whole way and support his view that a president is absolutely immune unless, again, they're impeached, convicted, and then prosecuted. And if you do that, you're starting to give credibility, even if one justice says that's true, you give credibility to a really abhorrent argument that the president of the United States is above the law. And I can't think of a more dangerous proposition than that in American history, because we're a country of checks and balances. And some of those checks and balances are implemented by the courts. And they mustn't default on their duty to make sure that Congress is subject to the rule of law, the president is subject to the rule of law, and the courts are subject to and follow the rule of law. And that's, to me, a real danger if they head down that road. And, of course, by picking the case up, they not only just delayed proceedings, but suggested that there's some sentiment on the Supreme Court that leans in that direction. That's kind of worrying.
Judge McCosher, I wanted to ask you about Merrick Garland. Attorney General Merrick Garland seems to be responsible for the 2.5-year delay in charging Donald Trump with his attack on the Constitution and interfering in the peaceful transfer of power. It's the major reason, it appears, that the nation is now in a race against time to hold Trump accountable before this November's presidential election. And of course, with the Supreme Court's intervention here, it looks like we're not going to get that accountability before Election Day.
Well, one thing's absolutely certain is the cases won't be over. None of them will be over before Election Day, but there might be a jury verdict. Of course, there's the case in New York that I have not mentioned about the hush money payment, and that's an embarrassment, I think, to everybody, but that's the case that's going to be going forward first, because there's so much more serious things that he's charged with, and you're going to go forward with this one, and it's just going to make kind of a mockery of the whole circumstance. But I think that if the Attorney General and the FBI had moved quickly right after the event, that they could have had him charged within, I mean, in reality, they could have had him charged within a few months. But let's say that they're always going to be foot dragging to a certain extent. They could have done it in 6 months. Instead, here we are with a case about the last election being finally considered and not considered yet, not tried yet, with the new election coming. And I think the Attorney General bears some responsibility for not seeing the magnitude of what had happened and moving on it quickly. But of course, they wanted to proceed with extreme caution with something so serious. But this extreme caution, and maybe that's what's happening in the courts now, is actually meaning that justice delayed can be justice denied.
That was Thomas McCosher, a former Connecticut complex litigation judge and author of the book The Common Flaw, Needless Complexity in the Courts and 50 Ways to Reduce It. Find a link to his recent article titled, With January 6th Case, the Supreme Court Could Take America Down the Dark Road to Dictatorship, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.